Professional wrestling is the one true sport. Other sports have their share of intense, dramatic moments, but nothing can compare with professional wrestling. Welcome to Wrestling History X, where three friends come together to talk about the stories behind the matches. I'm Matt.
I'm a member of the street gang known as the Bloods.
And I am the sixth member of the Heart Foundation.
Welcome to episode 257, King of the Ring, 1997.
It's bound to get medieval.
Brace yourself.
Medieval up in here.
Right?
Yep. There's still, it's funny that we've got a little bit more edge in WWF.
No, he hasn't debuted yet.
In the last 6 months or so. But they're still like doing the regal, not Steven, crown, and the like Chirons are all like knights and stained glass and stuff.
Ish.
You have the Jokers opening the door.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had to freeze the screen. And it's like,
the Hardys.
Is it somebody that I recognize? But I couldn't recognize them. So I don't know if they're anybody. Maybe Matt has that in his notes.
I don't.
Okay. Yeah, I am.
But this was the fifth annual King of the Ring pay-per-view produced by WWF. As they've done King of the Rings on TV before they did pay-per-views. It would take place on June 8th, 1997, from the Providence Civic Center in Providence, Rhode Island, with an attendance of 13,312 people.
Rack 'em in.
Yeah. Pretty,
it's everybody in
Rhode
Island.
Pretty decent crowd.
Yeah, for real. Smallest state. What is Rhode Island known for outside of being the smallest state?
Quahog clams. I don't know.
I guess that's where Family Guy,
it is where Family Guy is.
Takes place, yeah.
That's all I can think of anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can walk across the state in like 20 minutes or something.
I mean, I'm going there in June for a curling tournament.
So, oh, that's cool. Yeah. Maybe that's a good curl. Is curling popular there?
I mean, they have a curling facility, so.
I guess it's kind of in a good spot because you have, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, all that stuff. It's like, oh, well, we can all just meet in Rhode Island.
New England? Is that what you're going for?
That's the word I was looking for.
Okay.
Yeah.
New England, that whole area. That's, yeah.
But we are in Rhode Island.
Yeah, we are.
So, Shane, did you do what you do?
Ish. Yes, we are in Rhode Island. Here we are for King of the Ring. Yes, I did what I do, and I jumped on the Google machine and said, what do they have to drink in Rhode Island? What's their sandwich? What's their signature dessert? And a lot of the stuff that popped up there was not something I could find here in landlocked Oklahoma City as easily. So I searched around a little bit more, and going through their dessert list, it had two main options on there. One of them wasn't technically a dessert and contained ingredients that I know Matt wouldn't have enjoyed. It was known as coffee milk, where it's just coffee syrup and milk mixed together.
Ew, why would you do that?
I just
drink coffee.
I'll have to try it sometime just to see, but I'll have to find coffee syrup before I can do that.
You're a coffee guy, and
yeah,
that doesn't that sound bad?
I mean, it just sounds like, a coffee-flavored shake from some random place. Here's some milk base. Here's a little coffee syrup. We'll mix together, and it doesn't really taste like coffee. But yeah, so I passed on that one, and the other one that was on there was frozen lemonade. And I've had a couple of frozen lemonades here in Oklahoma City that were not the greatest because they're just this cup that sits in your freezer that you eat with a spoon. And I wanted something
Italian
a little
ice,
more.
Kind of,
yeah. So I looked around to see what frozen lemonade options they had here in the city, and one thing that popped up was from our friends over at Hideaway Pizza. They have a dessert on their menu called a frozen lemonade pie. And It's pretty simple. This one isn't quite as frozen because I put it in the refrigerator thinking that's where I was supposed to put it, even though it has frozen in the title. But it is more of a whipped, like a whipped cream consistency. A good lemony flavor, a good vanilla flavor. There's some graham cracker crust to it, and then a little bit of graham cracker crumbs sprinkled on top of it. It came with some sadly melted whipped cream by the time we got to it, and a lemon wedge.
It's good. It was very light.
It's very light. We have something similar to this at one of our company restaurants. We call it the lemon cloud pie, and it's very much like a key lime pie, just with lemon instead. I'm going to guess possibly Meyer lemons. But nice and fluffy, a good little crust to it. You can eat it somewhat guilt-free because it kind of takes up not a whole lot of room because it's very whipped.
Absolutely. Also, a wrestling treat that I've heard of is guys just getting whipped cream and like smashing a can because it's like, oh, I'm trying to keep up my physique, but like whipped cream, low calories, and I can just like lay in bed at the hotel and eat a can of whipped cream, and it isn't calorically isn't too tough on you.
Yeah, and you know, you get your sugar and whatnot for the day. But yeah, I'm guessing this would be even better frozen, so it kind of had a little bit of a bite to it. But even with it just being softened in a more whipped state than frozen state, it is still pretty damn tasty. It makes no noise when I take a bite because I've already taken one bite while I've been talking. But I'm going to take another bite because that's what I do. But if you're ever in Oklahoma City, swing by Hideaway. Try out their lemon cloud pie. See what it's like fresh from the store instead of a couple hours after.
Other deliciousness.
Maybe grab a pizza while you're there.
Get some pizza.
That's an Oklahoma favorite.
It's kind of the premier pizza place in Oklahoma.
It's been a long time since I had a paradise pie. Which is one of their pizzas, not an actual piece of pie. Piece of pie, not pizza pie.
Well, something that would happen right around the same time as King of the Ring, Married with Children, and Lois and Clark's final episodes would air on TV.
Lois and Clark did not last nearly as long, did it?
No.
No.
That show was probably, like, just canceled. Whereas Married with Children, it's like, all right, we ran all we could out of this.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to remember how many...
They actually, I mean, it ran 11 seasons. Married with Children was 11 seasons.
Which is crazy.
They actually thought they were going to be renewed, and it was like on the day of the finale airing, they got told, basically, no, we're not bringing you back.
I mean, it was... The era had ended.
It had.
For that show.
Yeah.
And I love that show.
It was one of the founding shows on Fox back in the day, and I mean, that's... People tuned into Fox back in the day because they had this white trash family on TV.
I mean, it's the precursor to Roseanne, mm-hmm. but it's less heartfelt and it's more like caustic.
Yes, this is more in your face instead of real life scenarios. You typically don't meet too many families that make a meal out of tipping the toaster upside down and getting the what they refer to as the toaster leavings.
But yeah, I do love Married with Children. Lois and Clark. I never watched it. Like, it would be on TV on, like, Sundays or whatever, and I just would, you know, go do something else. My mom watched it a little bit, I think. Yeah, I think she kind of followed it.
I watched one episode, and obviously, looks-wise, I was very much into Dean Cain.
I mean, can you imagine, like, two prettier people in 1997 on television than Dean Cain and Terry Hatcher?
But
what a combo.
I did not enjoy Terry Hatcher. I still don't really like Terry Hatcher as an actress.
I mean, I didn't say either of them were good actresses. Actors or actresses.
I've seen Dean be okay in some stuff, but Terry, I've never gotten behind in any
This is literally the only thing I think I've ever seen Dean Cain do.
Yeah, outside of...
I've seen a couple different movies that he did.
Were they the Christian movies?
No, this was before...
Okay.
This was back when he was still a working actor that just wanted to act and get paid instead of throwing political and religious stuff into it.
Yeah, what were they? Because when I think of Dean Cain, I think of Lois and Clark, and then I think of the John Mulaney joke where he says, "Is that Dean Cain?" And I can't even remember what the reference from the joke is.
Let me pull up his, as my friend Alex would say, his IMDb.
Yeah, we got it, Shane.
Just in case it didn't come through clearly over the microphone.
But, you know, Terry Hatcher had a much longer career.
She did. She's been in more successful things than him.
Desperate Housewives. I guess
technically he did do a... He was the father of Supergirl on the CW verse.
Smallville?
No, Supergirl.
Oh, there was a show.
Yeah.
My mom was a big Smallgirl. Let's rewind or small, back here Smallville fan.
Smallville.
Which I never watched either.
He's been in a whole lot more shit than I realized, because I just had to scroll way too far.
Because it's all, like, low-budget stuff that they get him to do, so they get some kind of budget. But, like, literally...
We can all agree, he's a great look for Superman, right?
Oh, yeah.
He looks great. Oh, yeah. But, I mean, also, it's like, well, yeah.
Best Men. Incredibly handsome man. Movie. Maybe he's not in the one I was thinking of, and I was just placing him in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he probably hasn't been in a movie as good as Dutch.
No, definitely not.
Dutch was great.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think Dutch is kind
of... Maybe mistaking him for someone else because I don't see this movie anywhere.
I feel like Dutch is an underappreciated film.
So, I think I was just more... I like to look at him more than I did technically watch him.
I mean, I probably feel the same about Terry Hatcher and Dean Cain because I'm like, well, I mean, I can appreciate a face like that.
Married with Children was the shit.
It's funny. It's
Lois and Clark.
It's a nighttime...
Shitty unless you're into that shit.
It's a nighttime soap opera, Superman.
See, I was allowed to watch Lois and Clark. Not so much with Married with Children growing up, so...
Yeah. I think I caught Married with Children mostly in, like, reruns. I was never watching it, like, weekly or whatever.
I always feel bad for Bud, because he's the one that just faded into oblivion of the main four.
Yeah.
Ed O'Neill, who came back.
It's weird seeing Katie Sagal as someone other than Peggy.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't look anything like Peggy
in real life. But it's kind even of...
more funny that at one time you had Married with Children and Roseanne as the two sitcoms of America and...
The white trash sitcom.
Yeah. And then when they killed Roseanne off of the Conners, they... brought in Katie Sagal.
Oh, really?
That's funny.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, Katie Sagal kind of still looks like Peg Bundy on the motorcycle show.
I didn't think she looked like her at all on the...
I mean...
Her in Sons of Anarchy. You know, that was where I saw her as finally somebody where it's not Peg Bundy, it's not Katie Sagal, she's actually Gemma. And anything else I've seen her in, she's just always had the same... character. Or
I don't think she didn't act the same as the character, but I still couldn't divorce it. I'm like, oh, that's still like, I couldn't divorce it completely. It's like she obviously was playing a different character.
But it was the coolest thing when Sons of Anarchy was going on and Modern Family had just started off, because you have Al Bundy and Peg Bundy who are being nominated for all these big awards the same years as each other, winning awards the same years as each other, and it was nice to finally see them get their flowers.
Yeah.
Christina Applegate. I don't know if anybody would know who the hell she was without Married with Children.
Anchorman.
I mean, she wouldn't have ever got Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead without...
Yeah. Don't Tell Mom. And then, like, Anchorman was the like...
I mean, Anchorman was long after her career had already...
Yeah, but that was, like, her big comeback. And I think that movie was such a hit that people think of Anchorman probably second.
She was on that show with... What was it? Dead to Me?
Yes.
Yeah. That everyone really liked.
Yep. They just had their last season last year.
I don't know what that is.
It's a Netflix show. Her and Linda Cardellini.
Cardellini.
It's a fun combo.
Yeah. The two of them are really good together. But yeah, I always felt bad for Bud because nobody really knows what the hell happened to him.
I mean, it's also tough because, like, number one, he is... It's like, yeah, we all know Tom Cruise is short, but Tom Cruise has... something extra that not everybody can...
He's a short king.
He is a short... And Bud...
Bud is a short joke.
He's a short jester, exactly. Because
Grandmaster B.
His whole thing is that the show shits on him. He's the punching bag of the entire show. So, like, where do you go from there when, like... I don't necessarily think he's an ugly guy, but he is short and squirrely.
David Faustino was a...
Yeah, not a bad
handsome
guy.
Feller.
Yeah, but...
But yeah, then you had the neighbors... Can't... Forget about old Steve and Marcy, and then Jefferson after Steve and Marcy split up.
Do you guys remember the...
Marcy Darcy.
Yep.
Do you guys
remember the name before?
Marcy Rhodes.
Rhodes, yep.
Do you guys remember the Married with Children ripoff?
where they tried to cast Joey.
No, it was like... Wait.
Yeah, well, there was the spinoff that was Joey.
No, no, there's one that's like just basically the same show again.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about the one with the rabbit?
Unhappily Ever After.
Yes. Unhappily Ever After.
Which I loved Unhappily Ever After.
I did too.
And also, that redhead girl. So hot.
Nikki Cox.
So hot.
But there was definitely more... They played up the sexual tension between the brother and sister on that show.
Yeah, that show was even trashier.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. It was perfect like timing for that show to be around. Yeah. But I knew even as a kid, like when watching Unhappily Ever After, that it was just a absolute ripoff.
Yeah.
But it was still, remember it being funny.
I thought it was very funny.
Yeah.
See, I didn't watch too much of that one. I remember when they tried to do the spinoff with, I don't remember what the guy's name, the character's name was, but Matt LeBlanc was the character, and he was...
Wasn't he
Rhodes? What's that?
Wasn't he one of the...
I want to say he was just... He was one of Kelly's boyfriends on an episode, and then they did, like, an entire episode of him and his dad at home.
Yeah, it was Vinny Verducci.
That's right.
Dated Kelly.
What was that show called?
Top of the Heap.
Never heard of it. There's one that I've always wanted to track down and watch.
Zap.
Which is a spinoff that failed horribly. The Tortellis. There was a spinoff.
Did you watch it?
No, I didn't watch it. It came out the year I was born.
But
like, Julie I don't
Lauren
think it...
Adams and Rita Moreno was in that show, too.
Huh.
In the Top of the Heap?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. But the Tortellis, I remember looking for it a while ago. It might have showed up on the internet at this point, but I just had a curiosity. Dan Hedaya, I mean, what a face.
The Tortellis.
But yeah.
I forgot about that one with him and his tall blonde wife.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember who she was. She was on the show. A lot of 80s stuff.
Yeah, she was on the on Cheers, mm-hmm. a handful, you know, a good amount.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're all...
Married with Children also has a wrestling tie-in because...
Oh, where is it?
King Kong Bundy.
Oh.
He played Peggy's aunt, which... Yeah, she's technically a Bundy by marriage, but yeah,
that's wild. I forgot about that.
And supposedly there's an animated revival happening.
Of Married with Children?
Married with Children, with all four coming back to voice.
That's really cool.
Yeah, also I think...
Because it'll allow Christina Applegate to work and still be Kelly without having to figure out how to do it with a cane and everything else.
Yeah, true bummer. That shit bummed me out so much. People,
Her speech at the Emmys was awesome.
Yep.
I didn't see it, but I remember, I was like, oh, what a bummer.
Yep.
Well, let's quit being bummed out.
That's right.
Let's talk some King of the Ring.
Hopefully the show will not bum us out.
I was going to say, let's hope this is a pick-me-up.
So we get black and white video highlights of competitors with narration. Tonight will be a night of firsts. Two reigning tag team champions will face each other for the first time. Which isn't true, as Bulldog and Owen had done so.
Just a couple weeks ago.
But they mean on pay-per-view. But they don't actually say that.
Even though Demolition faced off as entrant number one and number two in the Royal Rumble.
They're looking for respect from an unlikely source. Their partner.
Hmm.
We might see the first ever African-American WWF champion. But Farouk's not going into battle alone, as he has the support of the nation. Only for his opponent, The Undertaker, to have formed an unlikely alliance with Paul Bearer. There will also be a first-time winner in the King of the Ring tournament, and to the victor go the spoils. Super Soaker presents the 1997 King of the Ring.
The most royal and regal company there is.
I mean,
Super Soaker.
Laughed out loud when they said Super Soaker presents. I mean, everybody loves a Super Soaker, but...
So Super funny. Soaker doth present.
Vince McMahon then welcomes us to the show, joined by Jim Ross, before also introducing the international announce team.
Tito!
That's right, Tito was over there, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Over with Carlos Cabrera, or whoever that other guy was. I can't remember, but that's a name that just popped in my head.
sounds right.
Hugo Savinovich.
Mm-hmm. There's way more signs immediately in this crowd, and it's 316 everything, brother.
I mean, it's the anniversary of 316.
It's true.
So we go to our first match. Ahmed Johnson versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley with China in a semifinal of the King of the Ring tournament.
And the crowd is still red hot for Ahmed Johnson, mm-hmm. which I love to see in here.
So these two had actually already faced each other in this tournament when Triple H had lost by disqualification when China would hit Johnson with a chair. But Hunter threatened to sue the WWF, claiming the ref didn't properly explain the rules, not knowing that a disqualification would eliminate him. So the WWF would give him another chance, taking Vader's spot as he still hadn't recovered from his injuries from the Shamrock fight. And this time, Triple H would defeat Crush when Savio Vega would screw up a double team maneuver to advance.
Yeah, because Crush was gonna...
That's who everybody wants, Crush. Put him in the final.
So Ahmed would overpower Hunter early on with shoulder blocks and shoves before going into a test of strength. Only for Triple H to kick low to gain an advantage, chopping away, but Johnson just absorbs him, followed by lifting him up high with a gorilla press slam, sending Hunter to the floor to regroup.
I really can't reiterate how hot the crowd is. Mm-hmm. I love Ahmed Johnson.
13,000 people.
Yeah, but they actually care. We've seen 13,000 people not care about a match.
Mm-hmm. Once he returns, Triple H rakes the eyes, and he whips Ahmed to a corner, only for him to fire out with a clothesline, a body slam, and an attempted elbow drop, as Hunter avoids and tosses Johnson back out to the floor. Triple H whips Ahmed into the ring steps before delivering a baseball slide and tossing Johnson back in, where Hunter leaps in off the top with a flying axe handle for a two count. Triple H is punching away, but Ahmed starts to no-sell, followed by a scissor kick, a back body drop, and a spine buster, before calling for the Pearl River Plunge.
Yeah!
And China climbs up to the apron to distract Johnson, allowing Hunter to nail a leaping knee from behind, deliver the pedigree for the pin and the win.
Boom.
Yep.
Post-match, Triple H and China lead to the back with Ahmed giving chase, at least to the curtains, because then he just stops and like walks
through. Yeah, yeah. This is good, but Ahmed Johnson looks like a fucking star. He's treated like a fucking star. So I just assume that he won't be here much longer if he's not winning, which really bums me out because... He had so many hiccups, but people never turned on him, got tired of him, or bored of him. He looks like killer. He's even more comfortable here. He's more animated. It looks even more badass than he's ever looked. It's a bummer.
He didn't break the rules. He didn't break kayfabe, and come out on a show last year, and
yeah, Ahmed Johnson.
The change is coming, and it's coming soon. So we go to our second match, Mankind versus Jerry the King Lawler in a semifinal of the King of the Ring tournament.
So do we know, I can't remember what the date was for the ECW show. I'm just trying to figure out the timeline between
when. 2 days later.
2 days later? Okay.
2 days later than last week's ECW show. So Vince sends us to footage of Foley's first round matchup where he defeated Savio Vega while dealing with Lawler and Crush interference.
Again?
And Mankind takes the mic and asks where Uncle Paul went. That this is the biggest moment of his wrestling life. But apparently, Bearer has more important things to do.
And see, at that point, I thought he was talking about Heyman. Or Dangerously.
Yeah.
Just because of him wrestling Lawler in this match, I just... was assuming that he was talking the ECW angle.
Basically, they did this, so everyone's like, oh, Paul Bearer's not with me anymore because I'm not a heel anymore.
Yeah because you...
It's Mrs. Foley's baby boy.
Me, yeah. Between the last time we saw him and this time is when the whole Mankind JR interviews happened. We didn't get to see any of them. But
yeah.
Back in the day.
This, the guy's been... You can only be so good at being bad before people start to like you. It's, tale as long as time.
And Foley continues that he won't let that stop him on his quest to be king, before mentioning the history of both cruel and benevolent kings. But what kind of king do the fans want him to be? Mankind says that Lawler surrounds himself with royal robes, but as far as he's concerned, he's an emperor with no clothes. And there's only one thing more disturbing than that. Foley with no clothes.
Which
brings a good laugh from everybody.
Yeah, right? I mean, he's getting self-deprecating. He's, he knows... He just knows how to be likable, because he is.
Foley then finishes with, bang, bang! Before asking for some R-E-S-P-E-C-T, daring the king to sock it to him.
Doesn't at one point he says, I just can't wait to be king? And he's I got a kick out of that, just like quoting the Lion King.
We then go backstage with Todd Pettengill, who's with Lawler, where they show highlights of the king defeating Goldust on Raw with a leverage pin.
Boom.
But the Golden One doesn't like that too much, so he attacks, knocking the king down the ramp, followed by Marlena just stepping on him as she leaves. And Lawler takes the mic from Todd and tells him to get lost, before making his way through the curtain, insulting the fans on his way to the ring, followed by turning his attention to Mankind, saying he doesn't care about his history and childhood, something that was brought up in all those fantastic interviews with JR. The king continues by calling Foley an ugly freak of nature, claiming that when he was born, his mother took one look at his face and his rear end and proclaimed, "Oh my God, Siamese twins."
That was like one of those Lawler jokes that back then, it was dumb.
Yeah.
But that was the best one.
Yeah.
Mankind, that says a lot. Mankind grows tired of the insults, so he rolls out and attacks as the bell rings, brawling around ringside before returning into the ring. Foley then hits a back elbow and sets up for the claw, only for Lawler to bail out to the floor to regroup, grabbing an object from his tights and hammering Mankind several times to gain control. The king hits a bulldog, followed by tossing Foley out to the floor, before ramming headfirst into a ring post.
Posted.
And using the foreign object once again. Lawler then bites at the mangled ear of Mankind.
Weird and gross.
Before returning to the ring to continue the punishment with the foreign object and chokes.
It's like one of those things years later when Randy Orton is fighting Jeff Hardy. Takes whatever and puts it through the
screwdriver
spot. Yeah. And just starts twisting his ear.
That was one of those... That was like not a very good show or whatever, but like people still remember that spot because it was just bizarre and like kind of gross.
I mean, that was before he, set somebody on fire in the middle of the ring. So
he's
building up to it.
Yeah, but Randy Orton probably didn't have an issue with the screwdriver in the ear thing, whereas the catching a guy on fire in the ring thing was very stupid.
The fight heads to the floor and up the aisleway, with Foley running the king into multiple guardrails before trying for a running knee, only for Lawler to move, sending Mankind into the steel steps and allowing the king to regain control, throwing Foley headfirst into a guardrail and delivering a pile driver on the floor. Mankind makes his way to the apron, but Lawler dropkicks him back down. So Foley tries to get in once again, this time the king nailing another pile driver for a two count. He then hits some more foreign object, aided shots, but Mankind begins to fire up with right hands and a leg drop.
And this foreign object, it's like he's reaching, pulling his trunks out, up, and then putting his hand down them, and then grabbing something in there, and then pulling his hand out. You never see a thing. I believe that there's no roll of quarters. He is, he's just working some magic.
Foley continues with turnbuckle smashes, a running knee to the head, and a back body drop, followed by going for a neckbreaker, but it's blocked, allowing Lawler to nail a second rope fist drop. The king tries for another pile driver, but Mankind counters into a back body drop, only for Lawler to reverse it into a sunset flip, which Foley stays up and mandible claws down for the stoppage
and the win.
I mean, a good spot.
Agreed.
I mean, Mick Foley can kind of work with anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And him and Jerry Lawler is a good combo because they're both, like, bowling pin men.
Yep. And they kind of respect that old school...
Yeah.
I don't know, brawl around.
For sure. They have the right mindset to do it correctly.
If you're going to use an FO on somebody, Foley's a good one to...
Yeah.
To go for, because...
Even if it's an imaginary FO. Yep.
We go to the back, and Todd Pettengill is there with Brian Pillman. And we see Brian's wearing an Austin 316 shirt, but he's marked out the numbers and wrote 6997, which is the next day where he would be facing Stone Cold in a match on Raw. Mm-hmm. They were supposed to face each other on this pay-per-view.
Oh.
But due to other circumstances, which we'll talk about
later,
they're not facing each other.
That's interesting. I did notice the shirt, and I was like, oh, obviously that's he has a match with him.
So Todd asks if Pillman is responsible for the Austin versus Michaels match. And hell yes, he does. He reeled that sucker in, but it was Brett who inspired him. Pettengill then asks why Brian's there, which he responds that he's there to support the family and watch the boy toy violate that rat's ass.
Gross.
While Stone Cold has snuck up behind him with a maniacal grin.
And that part made me laugh, because, yeah, that's the Stone Cold that I enjoyed back in the day of, you can't see me, but I'm about ready to fuck you up.
Yeah.
All with this little, you know, dimpled grin.
Pillman continues talking about Austin, saying, seek and you shall find, which prompts Stone Cold to attack, dragging Brian to a toilet to give him a swirly. Where we even get an overhead shot of this.
Yeah, that blew my mind, because it's like, oh, you pull him in and you do the... And it, yeah, it's like, oh, well, he's obviously jamming his head in the toilet. But then there's a, like, camera, so the quality drops that they set it up, and it's like from the corner. It's like not... It'd be different if a guy, you know, put his camera over it, yeah. And it was like kind of shaking because it was heavy or whatever. But it felt very, very raw from... It felt Raw 98, which was, you know, some of the prime watching that I did.
I just wonder how many times that bathroom stall had to be cleaned before it was clean enough for them to be okay putting their head in it. But then again, it was Pillman. He may have been a little fucked up at the time, so it was just like, do it!
Yeah.
Woo!
So we go to our third match, Crush with the Nation of Domination versus Goldust. With Marlena. And the big man attacks as the bell rings, tossing the golden one out to the floor where the two brawl until Goldust can slam Crush's head into the ring steps.
Get him, Goldie.
Back in the ring, the golden one with mounted punches with some extra flair, followed by a clothesline for a two count. Crush reverses a whip but telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Goldust to nail a swinging neck breaker for a near fall.
Move of the year. Also, you know we're in a new place when Goldust is getting cheered.
Yes.
Crush reverses another whip to take control, delivering a belly-to-belly suplex and stomping away on the golden one, working the lower back with double axe handles, backbreakers, and rear chin locks.
Did you also notice Goldust's makeup?
Oh, yeah.
No, it's like a precursor to Stardust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got added the black in.
Black and gold, but then like star shapes around his face.
Yeah.
And yeah. As he walked down, it was like, I feel like I've seen this before.
Kind of has like a like Tron-esque vibe too, as far as like the, you know, lines down the face and stuff.
Goldust looks to rally after a knee to the crotch of Crush, but the big man with a gorilla press gut buster for a two count, followed by a nerve hold, which slows the momentum.
He's a heel.
Crush with a whip, but telegraphs another back body drop, allowing the golden one to hit a drop-down uppercut, a jumping clothesline, and flip-flop and fly, while the Nation begins harassing Marlena on the outside.
She needs to burn him with her cigar.
Goldust hits a bulldog of Crush, but then sees the activity on the floor, so he rolls out to protect his wife by slapping away the man who will be known as D'Lo. Only for the big man to come out and attack from behind. Crush rolls in the golden one and goes for another gorilla press slam. But Goldust floats over and nails a DDT for the pin.
And the win. And then their little cigar celebration in the ring. It was another one of those pulling back the veil of reality moments, because Vince at one point, when they're doing their little cutesy stuff in the ring and making little kissies and everything, that's when Vince announces that husband and wife, ladies and gentlemen, or they're married or something like that.
Yeah, which
like,
is,
whoa!
Yeah, because before it's like, well, we don't know if he's gay or what, or blah, blah, blah.
He's so bizarre.
Yeah. I believe there's been some interviews with Goldust during this time frame as well to kind of
come out,
change his character and humanize him a little bit more as well.
And also, like, textbook babyface win. Like, oh yeah, just a flash DDT and cover for the pin and the win.
Yeah. Fuck off,
it wasn't ceremonious. He was fighting from underneath and pulled it out.
We go backstage where Doc Hendricks is with the Legion of Doom and Psycho Sid. And Doc calls the Hart Foundation a close-knit unit. While these three have never teamed before, and the Harts want revenge. And Hawk says, revenge is a dish best served cold. And by Deadly Do Squat, we're serving the goldest dish in town.
And Sid is standing right behind him, mouthing the words, waiting for his
spot. Oh, really? And you can see it's like watching somebody, watching a two-year-old or, yeah, you
it's,
know, a
it's
second-grader
very much
read.
Will Smith from The Fresh Prince years ago with, he was doing that with.
Oh, really? Where you can see his, like, head move?
Well, yeah, he's sitting next to Don Cheadle as Don Cheadle is saying his lines in the show, you know, being broadcast on TV, and you can see Will next to him just mouthing the words next to him.
He's like, all right, this is my spot too. Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
Animal then questioned Hendrick's comment, as there's no tighter knit unit than the Legion of Doom. But he wants to know if he can trust Sid, who responds by telling the Road Warriors not to worry. He's the man and ruler of the world. And they can all agree on one thing. Tonight will be the worst night for the Hart Foundation. Doc then sends it to his twin brother from another mother, Todd Pettengill, who's with the Hart Foundation. And Bulldog starts by saying they will win fair and square, that there's no reason history won't repeat itself. Followed by Owen making Todd hold a slammy while he says the LOD have pretty makeup and funky Halloween costumes. But that doesn't cut it. Hart continues that the Foundation is family, and it takes more than makeup to beat them. That the Legion of Doom can't even trust Psycho Sid, which prompts Neidhart to say if Sid thinks he's crazy, he hasn't seen anything yet.
And then just like cold stop once the music starts.
Yeah.
So we go to our fourth match. The Hart Foundation of Jim, the Anvil Neidhart, British Bulldog, and Owen Hart versus the Legion of Doom of Road Warrior Hawk and Animal and Psycho Sid.
And they're still doing the big Sid Sparkler, you know, where it plays out his name. And he's still over.
So Animal and Hart start us off with the Road Warrior using his power advantage with slams, power slams, and just tossing Owen around the ring. Sid comes in to take over the attack on Hart and looks to go into a test of strength.
It's like you are 2 feet taller than Owen Hart.
But Owen would just call an audible and tag in Bulldog, who suplexes Psycho Sid, only for him to no-sell and clothesline everybody, followed by bringing in Hawk, who punches Davey Boy to his corner to tag in Neidhart.
And I know that Sid is huge. He's a very large man. But the true, like, I don't know if it dawned on me, but it reminded me of how large Sid was, that when Bulldog came in, he made Bulldog look like Owen versus, like, Stone Cold Steve Austin or something, where it's like, holy shit, like, Sid is a fucking monster. And it's crazy how large he is. And it's crazy that he can move the way that he does, considering how big he is.
The Road Warrior and Anvil exchange strikes until Hawk climbs the turnbuckles to fly off with a clothesline for a two count. And the Road Warriors instead triple team clobber down Neidhart before Hawk drop kicks him. So Anvil just backs up to tag in Bulldog, who takes the fight to the Road Warrior, delivering a pile driver, only for it to be no-sold, followed by a hot clothesline for a near fall.
Some a dose of your own medicine. Just no-selling everybody for so long, and Sid no-sells you. I believe they call it, just justice, but poetic justice. It's like, well, you know, poetic justice doesn't really make sense. It's just justice. Just sounds nice. Two nice words sound
good. A little bit of Sid justice.
There you go.
Animal returns, but is immediately taken down by a spinning heel kick from Owen, descending to the floor, where Anvil tosses the Road Warrior into the ring steps, followed by a chair shot across the back. Animal's rolled in, where Hart nails a snap suplex for a two count, before slingshotting Neidhart into the ring for a clothesline to get a near fall.
And as much as I love Owen and Neidhart, that spot feels pretty antiquated in 1997.
Mm-hmm. Though, we definitely haven't seen it in quite some time.
Yeah, and it just feels like it just feels too silly and unbelievable at this point.
Neidhart then telegraphs a back body drop, allowing the Road Warrior to hit a sunset flip. But Davey Boy is distracting the ref, allowing Owen to break it up. And the Foundation starts triple teaming Animal with a Hart missile dropkick and strikes in a corner, followed by double clotheslines, when Bulldog decides to go for a second rope crossbody, only for the Road Warrior to catch and power slam him down, climbing the turnbuckles, but Davey Boy then meets him there to nail a superplex for a near fall.
My God.
We get more triple teams by the Foundation, Anvil hitting some shoulder blocks in a corner, and a headlock to wear down Animal, followed by a whip-aided Owen as a battering ram into the Road Warrior's gut. And Hart continues with a neck breaker and a sleeper, only for Animal to slowly walk his way to the corner to tag in Hawk, fighting off Owen and going up top, only for Hart to move on a top rope knee drop. Bulldog is tagged in and he slams down the Road Warrior, but he misses a knee drop, only to grab the leg of Hawk for the Foundation to attempt a double clothesline, which Hawk just runs through before hitting one of his own. The Road Warrior then leaps to the corner for the
hot tag. And the crowd goes wild.
Sid hits clotheslines on everybody. Big boot and another clothesline to Owen to knock him out of the ring, before also choke slamming Davey Boy. And Psycho Sid then goes for a powerbomb on Bulldog, when Hart would leap in from the top turnbuckle with a sunset flip for the pin
and the win.
Psycho Sid just lost to a sunset flip
by Owen Hart.
And almost missed sunset flip because
yes.
He had to sit back up and grab him and pull him down.
Yeah, yeah, Sid was not ready for it. and it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, this match was kind of sloppy. Lots of sloppy.
I'm bummed that I didn't love this because I love all six men.
Well, that's the thing is, once upon a time, I loved all six of the men in the ring, but in this era, can do without Sid, I can do without the Road Warriors, and I can do without Anvil because they just get in the way. They have not adapted to the modern day as well.
Yeah, but I think that
haven't really held on to the old school either. They're just there.
I feel like, yeah, obviously Sid missed that cue at the end, but he's still over. He had his moment, but obviously he wasn't playing ball or didn't get along with somebody backstage. They just decided that's not the way they were going to go.
He wants to go where the big boys play, maybe. Yeah, maybe they threw some of that guaranteed money his way and said, hey, come on down.
Well, speaking of playing ball, we won't see Sid again for another couple of years, and this is the last time in a WWF ring.
Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a bummer, but I understand it.
And
Sid started
to
get over pretty hard, and I'm more sad to see Ahmed Johnson get lower status than I am Sid. Because Ahmed Johnson is better than ever at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Vince and JR then speculate about who will win King of the Ring. And Ross picks Mankind as a sentimental favorite, before showing us Austin's victory speech from the previous year. Top Pettengill is then in the back with Foley, who's holding his neck in pain, and says he doesn't feel like $1 million, but how does he look? Mankind then continues that Triple H will have to run him over with a train, that he's not going down for anyone, before quoting a line from a movie that inspired him. I just can't wait to be king.
There it is.
I was early on it. Yeah, he's squeezing in the charm.
Mm-hmm.
Self-deprecating, make himself... You know,
he's more like human than he's been since he's been there.
More human than human.
There you go.
Even though, you know, this isn't an ECW show. There, that's the Rob Zombie show.
So we get our fifth match, Mankind versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley with China in the finals of the King of the Ring tournament.
This is a feud that will carry the Federation for several years.
And McMahon and JR talk up the finishing moves of our competitors as they show footage of their victories earlier in the evening before Ross calls Triple H a blue blood while Foley has lost blood.
It's a good line.
It's a good line.
A very good line. Did you see the guy that like walked past the hard cam like between the first level and the second one, but he had a sign that just said Phil Mushnick sucks? I was like, that's such a weird sign to... write out and do. It almost felt like he was asked or dared to do it.
So is Phil Mushnick someone in sports, or is that just a random person?
Oh, no, he's a old promoter, I believe.
Okay. I didn't know if that was just, you were supposed to be here, you fucker, you didn't show up, Phil Mushnick.
No, he's, I believe he's an old promoter.
He's a sports columnist for the New York Post.
Oh, okay.
Was usually...
Did he do a story on Vince?
The beat writer for the Nets and the Rangers, mostly.
I think he was pretty cantankerous. And he probably shit on wrestling at some point.
Good word.
Oh, there was a feud with professional wrestling and its fans. He was a longtime detractor of the WWF, criticizing the lifestyles portrayed by Titan Sports, both in their storylines and the performers' personal lives. In 1997, he implied that Titan chairman Vince McMahon's perpetuation of steroid use for his performance led to wrestler Brian Pillman's early demise.
Yeah, but this is pretty bad.
McMahon responded that Mushnick was a self-righteous, egotistical, miserable son of a bitch.
I mean, Phil Mushnick, he kind of is. I've heard some of his articles after, now that you've said he was a columnist, but like he was a strict... You know, the tightest end of, like, Republican vibes as far as his reviews went.
Then why didn't Vince and him get along?
I don't know. Because he was attacking Vince's product. Because Vince McMahon is just... him and Donald Trump are essentially the same guy.
Yep.
Wow, some of the other things that he's gone off about... Just like...
Yeah, they're crazy.
Such as, like I said, I'm curious.
They're crazy. He's kind of comes off just like a racist dickhead.
The day after the September 11th attacks, he claimed that Mike and the Mad Dog, which is a radio show, had stated on air that all Jewish Americans should take a loyalty oath to the United States.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I said, he's fun to read about. His articles are fun, but he's not somebody you'd agree with. He might just be doing the... thing where it's like, oh, this is how I keep my job, is that I might have this feeling about this thing, but then I make it stronger in writing so that people have issues with me, and then I continue to write because people...
Oh, so he was Twitter before Twitter, huh?
Sounds like it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. He sounds like there's being a complete troll, and then there's the thing where it's like, oh, well, I just want to fuck with people, so I just plus up my opinion a little bit. I think that Mushnick was plussing it up, you know, maybe 10 or 20%.
Well, all right then.
Yeah.
So the match gets going with Hunter focusing on the neck early on, with Mankind ripping, clawing, and biting in response. But Triple H just rolls out to regroup. Now back in the ring, Hunter rakes the eyes and he stomps away to knock Foley out of the ring.
JR asks Vince McMahon if Helmsley has ever tried to buy the WWF. Because he's...
supposedly rich.
Yeah, and he's billed from being from...
Connecticut.
What's the...
Greenwich,
yeah. So it's... yeah. I just thought that was kind of funny, considering where we are at this point.
Foley then drags Triple H out as well, where the fight continues. But they return to the ring, where Hunter escapes mounted punches with a hot shot on a turnbuckle, followed by a swinging neckbreaker and chokes on the rope.
Move of the year!
Triple H goes back to the neck with an elbow drop and clotheslines before taking him to a corner to work Mankind over, where China gets a shot in as well. And Foley slows the momentum with a mule kick down low and charges at Hunter, only for Triple H to move, causing Mankind to get hung up in the ropes until the ref can release him.
Yep, and when he releases him, it's the neck spot where the ropes twist around between his neck, but he just like falls flat on his ass to the floor when he gets released. Also, the crowd, they loved Sid. They loved Ahmed Johnson. They're not loving this match. They're kind of quiet. You can hear a few people yell boring.
It's because, I mean, a lot of people expected Ahmed to be in the final.
Yeah. I don't blame them. I would have liked to see it considering how great that match was and his energy.
Mm-hmm.
Triple H doesn't have Ahmed energy.
Triple H nails a baseball slide to send Foley into the guardrail, followed by being thrown into the steel steps. Mankind's rolled in, where Hunter continues to work the neck with knee drops, twisting the neck and chokes across the ropes, before charging in, only to be hotshot across the ropes for a two count. And Foley takes control with another hotshot, a double leg takedown, a running knee, and a tree of woe attack, before tossing Triple H out to the floor, where Mankind attempts a baseball slide, only for Hunter to avoid, but then delivers a back body drop onto the concrete.
Ouch.
Damn.
Foley climbs to the apron, where he leaps off with an elbow drop, before dragging his opponent back into the ring, where Mankind nails a double arm DDT for the pin, and
no,
China has the ref distracted, so it only gets a two count.
I mean, good on her. It was pretty sloppy.
Foley then charges at Hunter, who kicks him low and attempts the pedigree, only for Mankind to reverse it into another back body drop, which Triple H counters into a sunset flip that Foley stays up and mandible claws down until China can pull Mankind out of the ring to break it up.
I mean, it's a callback. There's a reason that they... the way that they put these matches, it's like, oh, everybody obviously remembers that. Could it be the end?
The ref admonishes her as Hunter hits a hangman's neckbreaker to Foley as he's on the apron, causing Mankind to crash back down to the floor. Now back in the ring, Triple H climbs the turnbuckles, only for Foley to meet him there with another claw, only for Hunter to break up the hold with a thumb to the eye. But he then runs into an inverted atomic drop and multiple clotheslines that send them both out to the floor. And Foley climbs to the apron, leaping off with another elbow. But China pulls Triple H to safety just in time, causing the ref to just admonish her even further. Like, just kick her out, man. Like,
yeah.
If you're going to keep yelling at her. As Hunter tosses Mankind into the ring steps and taking him atop the announce table for a pedigree through it.
Is this the first pedigree through a table?
I think so.
I know. I mean, it becomes such a thing that here, yeah, I was like, oh, this feels like the first one.
Triple H heads back into the ring, taking the attention of the ref, allowing China to grab the King's Scepter to nail Foley across the back, followed by a Hunter running knee that sends Mankind off the apron and onto a production assistant trying to clean up the broken table mess.
Yeah, that looked bad.
It did look bad. And that, like, scepter cane shot, it broke so perfectly, and it sounded incredible.
And it went all directions.
Yeah, it sounded so good.
Triple H then drags Foley back into the ring, making the cover for the pin, and no, Mankind kicks out. So Hunter just follows up with a pedigree for the pin.
And the win.
Post-match, Triple H demands Todd Pettengill get in the ring to make the presentation, only for China to just shove him when he enters. Todd gives the cape and crown to Hunter, who just proceeds to destroy the crown by beating Foley over the head and back with it.
I mean, he has an ugly fucking crown anyways. So.
I mean, yeah. Supposedly he hated that whole crown shit at this point.
The new king of the ring and China leave with Mankind crawling after them. Yeah, the reason he destroyed the regalia was because Triple H refused to add it to his gimmick.
Good.
Basically.
Yeah, he was tired of being Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Mm-hmm. He wanted it to be something else. Can't blame him, but I also don't know that he's been compelling enough.
I mean, if you don't
want you have to do gimmick, something else to be.
Say, I don't want to win it.
Yeah.
Give it to Ahmed.
It's weird that I'm bummed that I don't.
I don't think he makes that.
No, he doesn't. No. But, yeah, it's a shame because, like, I find him winning the King of the Ring, like, not exciting at all. And neither does the crowd.
I mean, the thing is,
it's cool. He'll win.
Ahmed's been an Intercontinental Champion. Triple H has been an Intercontinental Champion. Mankind's been in world title matches. I mean, we're not even count Lawler because they just had Lawler there so that there was.
So Mankind had a match.
Like, the people they had in this King of the Ring tournament didn't need this win.
Mm-mm. No, Hunter Hearst Helmsley needed it more than anybody else, probably.
I mean, he'd started getting. He's getting his heat now because of China being there. And we all know what happens here in a few months. He teams up with his click buddy, you know, and that pushes him over the top.
Mm-hmm.
So
he didn't necessarily need to win.
He doesn't necessarily. None of them necessarily. I mean, Ahmed probably
would have been my most satisfying.
Needed it the most, but I think, like I said a while ago, there's a change coming for Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wins King of the Ring, I don't know if they can make that change.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really work. So.
But I love Ahmed as a ass-kicking babyface.
They missed out on King Crush, I'm telling you.
I mean, I'm not saying that Crush or Savio needed to win it either, but...
No, they definitely
like didn't. They should have had... I mean, technically, I almost wonder if Rocky was supposed to win this.
But they already pushed
him too hard.
Yeah.
That by this point they couldn't put him in this tournament.
So I'm trying to remember.
It works out very better for him.
I mean,
or is he just not on camera?
I think he's just not on camera. Okay. Give him a little bit of a reset, basically.
Yeah, because
out of all the people that we've seen, he's the guy that probably needs it the most.
I mean,
but everyone's sick of him also at this.
You got a guy that already wears a gold cape and all this other stuff, just. Make it official. The Golden King, or something.
Blog. Just have RVD come in and win it all.
There you go.
I mean, we all love RVD.
So Vince sends us to a video package about Austin and Michaels, where we get highlights of the Heartbreak Kid attacking the Heart Foundation with narration. And Shawn has returned from injury to form an unlikely alliance with Stone Cold, putting aside their differences to fight the Foundation, as we see footage of them tagging together. Reality found its way into the picture as the hated Odd Couple has won the tag belts, when Mayhem replaced Celebration after the bout, where Austin abandoned Michaels to zero in on Bret Hart. Controversy substituted for camaraderie as the Heartbreak Kid confronts Stone Cold in the locker room, as one must wonder if this showdown was crafted by the Hitman, as the once plotted demise of the Foundation has been twisted into a competition of, can you top this?
Pretty crazy they did that all in a month, because these guys did not have the tag belts on the last pay-per-view.
Mm-mm.
Impressive.
So we go back to McMahon and JR commiserating over their broken announce table before singing the praises of Mankind, when the Hart Foundation would interrupt them and make their way to the ring. Pettengill would join them, only for Bret to take the mic and tell him to get lost, followed by telling the fans to shut up. And the Hitman would tell everyone that he is no longer a cripple to be bullied, and the time is coming for retribution, before introducing the rest of the Foundation, saying he has allowed them to pump their blood with his heart. Bret then makes a challenge for In Your House Canadian Stampede, asking for any 5 WWF wrestlers to cross the border to come into his hometown and face the Hart Foundation. But don't be surprised when everyone has sudden injuries. The Hitman then makes his way over to the announce table to join, but they don't have an extra headset, so the Foundation just begins to intimidate Vince and Ross until officials arrive to make them leave.
I will say that the message was good, but Brett, live heel promo in the ring, not the hottest shit.
No, but he fumbles
a little bit, but like he has some good lines.
Yeah, angry Brett promos I still enjoy, just because...
I mean, I love him dearly.
He didn't really give the best face promo either.
No, he's just not the best
promo. That's why he was always the best when he had, I should say on the microphone, when he had Jimmy Hart speaking for him back in the day in the Hart Foundation. But I would much rather hear angry Brett do a promo than...
Face Brett.
Face.
Yeah. I don't think it was bad, but you could tell that he wasn't particularly comfortable and he didn't nail it, but it wasn't awful.
We go to the back with Doc Hendricks, who has Austin with him, saying that he and Michaels are not friends, but being champs puts green in their jeans. And Doc follows up by asking where Stone Cold draws the line on hurting each other, with Austin responding that being a champ does make you more money, and he doesn't want to cripple the Heartbreak Kid, that he will keep him around as long as he's useful. But if Sean raises the violence factor, he'll do it. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so. And the camera follows Austin out of the locker and through backstage as he makes his way to gorilla position, where the Hart Foundation has just arrived. So he flips them off before going through the curtains and to the ring. Vincent sends it to video clips of Stone Cold attacking Pillman from earlier before seeing him taunting McMahon. As Vince says, you can't trust Austin. And we go to the back again, where Hendricks is now with Michaels, asking if the end will justify the means, if it hurts the tag team. The Heartbreak Kid responds that the Hart Foundation wants them to destroy each other, but he doesn't want to do it. That the whole world expects the classic of a lifetime, before asking Doc what he should do. Which, of course, Hendricks is no help as Sean makes his way to the ring, where some female fans hand him roses and grab at him.
I do love, Sean just gives a non-answer, and Stone Cold's answer is like, well, you know, if he oversteps his bounds, then I'll meet him.
So we go to our sixth match, Stone Cold Steve Austin versus the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels. And the story behind this match was that HBK and Bret Hart were supposed to have a rematch on this show, with the Hitman claiming he could beat Shawn in 10 minutes, but if he didn't, he'd never wrestle in America again. Bret would call Michaels a degenerate, and standing up from his wheelchair, only for HBK to superkick him. But this would be missed, as the show had already gone off air. So then real life happened, with Sean accusing Hart of doing it on purpose, going off script during a promo, making the sunny days comment at this point, causing the tensions between the two to be at an all-time high. So President Gorilla Monsoon would force Austin and Michaels to team up, where they would win the tag belts, but would be attacked after the match, only for Stone Cold to go after the Hitman's knee, causing the cancellation of the proposed match and leading to this matchup.
A little convoluted, but it checks out.
I mean, basically, Bret wasn't 100%, ready to go in the match, so they needed to do something different. And
what's the hottest match you're going to have?
They decided we need to save this something for a little while down the line. That way we can have a camera rolling when he gets called a degenerate and then build up to what happens next.
So our two men get into each other's face before Austin tells the Heartbreak Kid that he's number one, as a fan jumps the guardrail with security tackling him.
This is the most weird and cringy shit.
But Sean recognizes that the young fan is a special needs kid.
I mean, how did the security knot. He has Down syndrome. We all know what people with Down syndrome look like. It's crazy.
They see somebody jumping the fence. That's all they're supposed to look for.
Yeah, but he's 5'2" and looks sleepy.
That don't matter. You gotta worry about those little ones.
Sean heads outside and he calms the situation for momentarily, only for Stone Cold to meet him there to begin brawling. And the two trade takedowns, with Michaels getting the advantage. But he first goes back out to the floor to escort the young fan back to his mother.
Are they just trying to make Sean a bigger baby face?
I mean, he's the baby face technically in this match. Yeah, so I think it was once the situation happened and Sean was like trying to just de-escalate the
situation. I thought the situation felt planned.
No.
Really?
No.
Oh, it felt planned.
I don't think Stone Cold attacks him if it's planned. Because Stone Cold, I don't think, realized what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was just like, why are we not fighting?
Well, I feel a little bit better about it because this just felt like a weird plant to make. Because it looked, you know, it went smoothly, I felt like. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I'm, yeah. Yeah. Good for him. One of my favorite internet videos of all time. You ever seen it? It's like a Down syndrome guy and he's out back like a pool. And they're like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And he's got like two beers in his hands and he smashes them together like right next to the hot tub. And they're like, why the fuck would you do that? And he's like, yeah, it does a Stone Cold. So cute. It's very funny.
So Heartbreak Kid returns to the ring where the two are back and forth with headlocks, followed by a Fez press attempt by Sean. Only to be caught in an atomic drop before being clotheslined out to the floor. And Austin heads out to keep up the attack before bringing Michaels back in the hard way, only for HBK to float over and deliver an O'Connor roll for a two count, followed by Sean going back to Matt Holtz. And Stone Cold takes a walk to regroup, but he returns to go into a test of strength, with Austin nailing a cheap shot to gain the advantage, only for Michaels to fight back to hit a back body drop for a near fall. And the two trade missed elbow drops, which allows the Heartbreak Kid to go back to an armbar, followed by them running the ropes, leading to a Stone Cold Fez press that lands, before they go into multiple pinning sequences that get two counts for both men, until Austin just throws Sean over the ropes to the floor. Now Stone Cold drags Michaels back to the apron, only to snap his neck across the ropes multiple times, followed by a forearm that sends the Heartbreak Kid flying off into a guardrail. And Austin rolls out and removes the padding before delivering a not-so-rubber band slam to Sean onto a steel railing and a press slam onto the concrete. Stone Cold then drags Michaels back into the ring where Austin whips him to the ropes, only to miss a clothesline. So HBK bounds off with a jumping forearm that Stone Cold ducks as well, sending Sean back out to the floor.
I mean, this crowd is hot as hell, and these guys are moving so goddamn fast. Mm-hmm. Like, when they run the ropes, it looks insane. Nobody runs the ropes like that. Nobody looks like that aggressive or quick or purposeful running the ropes.
Back in the ring, the two trade pin attempts and clotheslines until Austin hits a second rope elbow drop for a near fall before going to a chin lock, using the ropes for leverage when the ref finally catches him to force a break. And on their feet, the two exchange strikes when Michaels would toss Stone Cold out to the floor, following out with a baseball slide before attempting to bring Austin in the hard way, only for Stone Cold to float over and whip HBK to the ropes, where he bounds off with that jumping forearm that lands this time. A back body drop, atomic drop, and a whip to a corner by Sean. But Austin avoids a charge in, sending Michael shoulder first into the post.
Posted.
Followed by Stone Cold grabbing a handful of tights, exposing his buttocks. To pull HBK back into the ring. Sean then leaps up and out with a crossbody after being sent to a corner, only for Austin to use the momentum to roll through and on top for a near fall. Stone Cold with a clothesline before sending Michaels to a corner for a flare flip, followed by the Heartbreak Kid reversing a whip to boomerang Austin back into a corner where the ref is wiped out.
Ref bump. It's a really good ref bump.
Shawn goes for sweet chin music, but his foot is caught, allowing Stone Cold to hit a stunner. But the ref is still out. So Austin wakes Tim White, only to deliver a stunner to him.
The logic is kind of flawed.
He had to be there.
Stone Cold then walks into some sweet chin music. When Mike Chioda runs down, but he goes to check on White first instead of making a count. So the frustrated Michaels then nails Chioda with sweet chin music before dragging the original ref over to make the count for the pin. And no, Austin kicks out. Earl Hebner then makes his way down as Heartbreak Kid is yelling at White and begins to yell at both competitors, calling for the double disqualification.
And as soon as that, like 30 seconds after the first ref bump, after Austin, you know, does the visual pin, but there's nobody there, the crowd is just booing because they know what's coming.
Post-match, Stone Cold grabs both tag belts and tries to hit Shawn with one of them. But Michaels avoids and grabs one of his own. So they begin staring each other down some more until Hebner convinces them to head to the back. And Austin and HBK continue to argue as they leave together with them keeping an eye on each other.
JR says it's kind of like kissing your sister. Gross.
So we go to the back. Todd Pettengill's there with Farouk and the Nation of Domination. Todd shows footage of them attacking Taker on Raw, saying that Farouk has a chance to become the first African-American WWF champion. The militant responds that chance is for old folks and fools. That history will be made tonight. The Hicks can punch it into their record books. Followed by, Undertaker, don't worry about Paul Bearer's blackmail. Worry about this blackmail.
I mean, you know I got a fucking kick out of that one. My God.
And as he makes his entrance, Doc Hendricks interviews the dead man and Paul Bearer, telling the champ that everyone loves him, no matter what the secret is.
Yeah, that was weird.
And Taker begins to respond when Bearer would just say, "Zip it, Lazarus."
Yeah, it feels like they're like prying into Taker like he was like sexually assaulted as a child or something like that. And it's like, what's the big deal, man? Just let us know. And he's like, shut up. Don't talk to me. This isn't your business. It's very weird.
Paul then tells Mr. Microphone to stay out of their business. The Undertaker will do whatever he says as long as he has the secret and do it when he says to do it.
Also, Paul Bearer. Hair is no longer black. It's full on regular red, natural hair color, and he's not doing the high voice. He's just speaking like a
white face makeup.
Nope. Yeah, he just looks like
he's just Paul Bearer instead of a Paul Bearer.
He's just Percy Pringle here.
He's very Percy Pringle.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's good. It's nice because that voice is a lot sometimes.
So we get our seventh match, Farouk with the Nation of Domination versus The Undertaker with Paul Bearer. And the story behind this match was that the militant had questioned the WWF about their lack of black champions, saying they would give them token victories, but never the big one.
And Vince McMahon says that he's been pulling the race card, which I was just like, yeesh. Like, you could say it the way Matt just did, and it doesn't sound so awful.
Yeah.
Even Ahmed Johnson agreed with his rival.
Mm-hmm.
As he probably should.
The Nation would attack the dead man, with Ahmed going out to help, only to accidentally be tossed into some ring steps. However, this was the least of Taker's worries, as Paul Bearer had returned from the fireball thrown in his face, saying he had a dark secret. Something about three graves. About the Undertaker's past, revealing it unless he was taken back into as his manager. And the dead man would accept him back begrudgingly to protect those he loved.
Dead man can't love.
So Farouk would attack as the bell rings, but Taker fires back with right hands, clotheslines, and a big boot for a two count. The Middleton responds with a power slam, followed by the Nation distracting the ref, allowing Crush and Savio to get in some shots as well. Farouk then charges into a big boot, so Undertaker takes him to old school. But instead of leaping onto the Militant, he jumps off onto the Nation on the floor.
And it's such a nice spot because it's so uncharacteristic of the Undertaker.
Then.
Yeah, yeah, at this point, yeah.
It becomes a calling card. Does pretty it? Soon after that.
Yeah, yeah, but at this point, it's like, oh, wow, this is pretty different.
As Taker makes his way back to the apron, the Militant tries for some forearms, only to be hot-shotted atop the ropes, followed by the Dead Man going for old school again.
Don't go back to the well.
When the Nation would shake the ropes, causing Undertaker to crotch himself. Now Farouk hits a snap suplex for a near fall, only for Taker to rise and clothesline the Militant down. But he walks into a low blow, and the Nation gets some cheap shots in from the outside.
Nation really going in from the floor as soon as his head's anywhere near the apron. The thrown bow, thrown fists.
Farouk tosses the Dead Man to the floor, following out and grabs the ring steps, charging at his opponent, only for Undertaker to boot them back into the Militant's face. Now back in the ring, Taker delivers knee lifts and right hands, but telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Farouk to nail a pile driver for a two count.
I mean, I popped for that.
The Militant then applies a chin lock, using the ropes for leverage, until the Dead Man can escape with a jawbreaker and tries for a splash in the middle of the ring, only for Farouk to get his knees up. Undertaker then counters a Dominator attempt by backdropping the Militant over and going for a leg drop, but Farouk moves in time. Taker then reverses a whip, sending the Militant to a corner, charging in, but he gets a knee to the face, allowing Farouk to climb to the second turnbuckle, where he leaps off, but he's caught by the Dead Man and slammed down. Undertaker continues with more strikes, but he has his whip reversed, only to duck a clothesline and bound off the ropes with a jumping clothesline that the Militant ducks, leaving both men down on the mat. And all of a sudden, JR says that Crush has pushed down Clarence Mason.
No.
And the Nation begins arguing with each other on the outside, while Farouk body slams Taker. And the Militant sees the Nation being fools out on the floor, and he makes his way over to yell at him to stop. When the Dead Man would attack from behind, delivering the Tombstone Piledriver for the pin
and the win.
Post-match, the Nation comes in to attack, only for the Undertaker to chokeslam both Savio and Crush. And the Nation begins to make their way to the back, with Farouk still laid out in the ring, when Paul Bearer would demand that Taker chokeslam the Militant, but he refuses at first, until Paul grabs him by the hair.
The secret is too big.
The Dead Man then chokeslams Farouk, followed by Bearer forcing him to do it multiple more times, when Ahmed Johnson would come running down to the ring, yelling at Undertaker to stop. Farouk's a human being!
Are you listening to me?
Yeah. It's like, well, obviously Taker doesn't want to do it, but he's kind of getting cucked.
Ahmed asks why Taker is listening to Paul, telling him to get it together, only for the Dead Man to turn away, so Johnson shoves him. Undertaker retaliates by throwing a punch, but Ahmed ducks and delivers the Pearl River Plunge.
Ah, the coolest move ever.
Before leaving the ring. Bearer then yells at Taker until he rises and begins chasing Paul out of the ring as Vince says his goodbyes and we fade to black.
Yep.
So I ask you, gentlemen, what are your overall thoughts of King of the Ring 1997?
This is a transitionary show. Not a bad one, but a transitionary show where it's like, all right, we're setting stuff up. This feels like a long in your house almost.
It feels almost, possibly, like the first 3 hour Raw.
Oh.
But not a good one. Like, it's...
I think the show's fine.
It sets the... You know, it plants some seeds for the future, but... I mean, I'm with the crowd. They were bored. And
They were.
I know I'd seen it before, yeah. But it was a mostly boring show. I mean, the actual lineups... I mean, you got Sean and Austin, which is great.
Great. You
got Mankind and Hunter, which should be great, but it's not what people wanted because...
People didn't care about Hunter at this point
no.
in any real way. There's a weird thing where the... Like, Austin and Michaels is obviously an incredible match. It's great. But you can't do this angle with just anyone. Like, this angle doesn't work with really anybody else on this. It only works with those two guys at this point in time.
Yeah,
it is just pure...
You can't give either guy a loss at this
point. Yeah, but, like, you could do that, like, with people, and it would be with Mankind and, like, Goldust, or Mankind and Taker if they were a tag team. But, like, for some reason, these guys can pull off this angle, because this angle's... kind of silly, but they can pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody can pull it off, so that's kind of like, hey, you have lightning in a bottle, and you got lucky that you closed the lid in time for this like one match, but you can't just keep running this. You can tell it's a transitionary thing.
Oh, yeah,
These guys aren't going to be tag team partners for an extended period of time.
The one match I'm okay with.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything else is... It made the show feel unimportant.
Yeah, I mean...
You could have had a Saturday night's main event or something like that and had it just be Austin versus Michaels.
For sure. I mean, the crowd was hot for Ahmed Johnson, which really just breaks my heart that...
And then they lost all interest in the show until Austin and Michaels.
Yep, yeah.
It's like that Royal Rumble where everybody wanted Daniel Bryan to win, and then he, as soon as he got out, nobody cared. They booed Rey Mysterio.
Yeah, a guy that's like impossible to boo.
Daniel Bryan wasn't even in that Royal Rumble.
Oh, that's right. He wasn't in that one, but there was one he was in.
30, and then
yeah.
Rey Mysterio came out, and so then they started booing Rey
Mysterio.
That's
what it was. But then there was another one he was in where he got out early, and everybody was pissed. They didn't fucking care about anything.
This is a disappointing show to me.
I agree.
like you guys said, there's one good match, and...
It's a great match.
And we had to have shenanigans to end it,
mm-hmm.
because, like I said...
Not mad at the shenanigans.
They can't afford to give either one a loss at this point.
And there's a golden moment where it's like, okay... Weird finish, but I understand. But when they start walking back next to each other, and Austin like gives a look over, it's like, fuck, that guy gave me a run for my money. That sells. Like, the match was already great, but that makes the end okay. And it's just something that he did with his face.
We discussed it a while ago. Like, the whole King of the Ring thing, like, it didn't help anybody.
No.
And
plus the fact that they just... They buried it.
They basically, you could tell that both guys were going, having them go out there and do like a 20-minute match after they've already wrestled.
They needed their spot, the break spots.
Just seem dumb. Like, make that a 12-minute match, get it in, get it out.
That pedigree should have happened earlier. He should have, should have been like 6 minutes, pedigree to the floor, Mick Foley tries to make a comeback, gets caught, pedigree, 1, 2, 3.
Farouk, like, I like the guy.
And I don't think the match is bad. Him
and Undertaker had no chemistry.
Mm-mm.
And
it's like they just met.
Did anyone actually think Farouk had any chance in the match?
Nope. No.
It's obviously a filler feud because like the next time we see Farouk in the Nation of Domination, it's going to be completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Because the next night on Raw, he fires Crush and Savio. Literally, it's him and D'Lo is all that's left of the Nation of Domination.
Oh, a clean house.
And it begins to get rebuilt. But it also leads to the faction warfare thing that they start doing.
Because Crush goes out and starts the Disciples of Apocalypse.
Savio does the Los Barricos.
Yeah.
So we
Barriquas.
Barriqua.
So, I mean, we get some infusion of a different kind.
Like I said, it's planting seeds. It's just... It was a
transitionary show, but not
show,
necessarily a good
but
one.
But this show itself, like...
It was like watching grass grow.
Yeah.
Good way to put it. It was like watching grass grow.
Uh-huh. Like, yay, it's, here's this exciting part. It's blooming. All right, now it's done. Okay,
Good, where's the smart marks at? All right, fuck you.
I think it's time we smart it up. So what are some of the best moments of this show?
I mean, I just talked about it, but
so
like...
So which part of the one match are you going to talk about?
The finish of the Austin and Michaels match. Mm-hmm. I understand it completely, but it's not particularly satisfying for a crowd of 13,000 people. And the crowd probably doesn't see this, but we see this at home, and they can replay it as much as they'd like because it's on camera. But Austin's look over, like they both walk back at the same time, and his look over that like shows
they don't trust each other.
Respect, but a lack of trust. And he just does it all with, it's like a half a second, just a face and a head lift. And it makes it incredibly intriguing where we go from here. And these guys, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody run that fast off the ropes in a purposeful or violent way. I've seen plenty of people run the ropes very quickly, but these guys, there was weight in their feet.
Don't worry about Paul Bearer's blackmail. Worry about this blackmail.
I mean, come on.
It's a great one.
Like, there were some great lines that people delivered.
Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, there's some really good promos on this show.
I mean,
Bret Hart's his promo wasn't great, but his line about like these five guys pump blood to my heart or whatever. It's like, oh, that was good. That was a good line. Intelligent.
I mean, I know I mocked it, but the Sid mouthing,
yeah, that was
LOD's
funny.
Lines cracked me up.
Diddly do the squat.
Whatever that means.
Or Mankind's I Can't Wait to Be King.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
That was probably the best, like we just said.
It was funny.
The best parts of the show are like the stupid sayings that were in some of these promos.
Yeah, outside of the one really great match. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, shortlist quality match. But the other matches were, they were all fine.
Were they?
But they were mostly fine. But they never reached any, like... They never got to the next level. It's like, all right, we got out of first gear, we made it to second gear, but like they never got over fucking 80 miles an hour.
Until Sean and Austin.
Until Sean and Austin went in there,
ran back and forth.
Yeah, and they did 120 to the next town.
I don't know if y'all noticed, but Todd Pettengill just kept being kicked out. Like every time, it's like, oh, let me come interview, and it's like, oh, and did they just? Kick it out. Him, yeah. Just be like, get out of the ring.
Yeah.
Bring me the microphone. I get the
Give me
away.
The microphone. Ahmed hitting the Pearl River Plunge.
Pearl River Plunge on Taker.
I literally didn't know. I didn't know about this. So I mean, I'm going to even tell you that's my surprise that he comes out and hits the Pearl River Plunge on Undertaker. That's my surprise of the night. Cause
yeah, no, I agree. And it was also a
I
perfect.
I was like, oh.
Perfect Pearl River
this
Plunge.
This is a perfect. Like
perfectly.
Oh, so we're not going to have him win the King of the Ring when he's probably the only person that possibly needed it.
Yeah,
I would say that
of the people that had in it.
I mean,
he's the one who
literally
should have had it.
They literally just put him in the next level by doing this one thing.
He was definitely the fan favorite in the arena. Mm-hmm.
But it's also Undertaker, who's a fan favorite. So it's kind of like, so are we going to have a face versus face matchup on the next show? It was like.
But yeah. Undertaker's back with evil Paul Bearer, so...
But he doesn't want to do it.
But everyone knows that he doesn't want to do any of it, so...
Yeah, but it makes him look like a wiener. This is the first time I've ever seen Undertaker look like a wiener.
Yeah, that's
like, he looks like a bitch because somebody's holding something over his head. Which is very bizarre.
Like...
I mean, that's a... We're going to move on to most disappointing, because we know we got a few things, but right there, that's definitely one of them.
Yeah, Doc Hendricks, we love you, we care about you.
Yeah, you don't say that to the Undertaker.
No.
It was so uncomfortable and bizarre.
You don't speak to the Undertaker. You let him...
Zip it, Lazarus.
Yeah. That was a very good line on the show. Show's full of good lines.
I mean, I mean,
there's a lot to choose from.
Why are some of these people in this King of the Ring tournament? They make... Like, we know that the mid-card in WWF at this point is weak.
You got Jerry Lawler showing up on ECW show last week. Why can't somebody from ECW show.
Don't think
upper mid card, because I'm like, well, I mean, Goldust, Mankind, Ahmed Johnson. I mean, Goldust, pretty great.
Goldust and Crush had this match that there was. The only reason they had this match is because they needed to fill some time.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point. Yeah, yeah. It's like oh, there's, yeah, people cheered for Goldust, but they were going to do that anyway.
Yeah. Because nobody likes Crush.
Yeah. Where was Flash Funk on this?
He's a jobber.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bummer. He's a
jobber. I mean, he's the guy who loses to RVD the next night on Raw.
It's a true jobber when you're losing to the ECW flown-in talent.
Mm-hmm.
When is Vince putting over another promotion ever? Like, spoiler alert for like 6 years in the future, but like, he owns ECW and WCW, and he still doesn't put any of them over.
Nope. Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm.
That's how low he is.
Sign Sting, and you give him a WrestleMania match, and you don't even let him win that. You confuse
any
things.
Any other disappointing moments? I mean, we can probably talk about a few of them.
Yeah, it's really funny that. Last week we watched the like change of the guard that felt organic and exciting on ECW.
Yeah.
And then we go here and there's like, you said, like watching grass grow. It's like, oh yeah, this is going to be really nice, but it's still going to be, you know, a while. There's still, yes, somebody let their dog piss on our yard and there's still going to be a few yellow spots. We're looking at you, Crush.
Still looking at you, Crush.
Yeah. We're looking at you, Sid, even though the crowd was behind you. And I've been pro Sid for a minute, but I get it. It's not a fit.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, that tag match, the foundation against them, it just...
It didn't come together.
It was awful.
Yeah.
It was just sloppy and sloppy and sloppy.
They never hit a stride. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they never, yeah, quite.
I mean, maybe Sid didn't care because it was his last pay-per-view. I don't know if he's gone after this night or if he's still got some TV time left, but...
Sid?
Yeah.
I think he appears on the next night and that's his last match.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they gave him a good goodbye as far as, like, okay, he was, like, upper mid-card, but crowd was going wild for him. And then here he still gets, he's tagging with the Road Warriors. And they still do the Sparkler Sid thing, and the crowd goes nuts. I think the biggest pops of the night for single wrestlers are Ahmed Johnson and Sid. Like, Austin and Sean, they both get huge pops, but, like,
it's really
in a match
sad.
Where everybody is obviously behind this one guy, one guy, it's like Ahmed Johnson and Sid. Everybody wanted Sid. They chanted, they wanted Sid in the ring. And then with Ahmed Johnson, all they wanted was for him to win King of the Ring, and he didn't.
I mean, they missed Sid. He was walked into WrestleMania a few shows back as champion, main evented WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, now he has this match in the middle of the show as the bathroom break match. And yeah,
but just gone. Like not too long ago, he was kind of doing some of the best work
he was
of his
in
career.
The best run of his career.
I mean, people chant, "This is awesome!"
Six, it's been six
at every WWE
time.
Show. But...
They do, but I agreed with them from like 2023 or 2024, like watching Sid promos, and you know, it's like I saw him. We watched him in WCW, and you're like, okay, yeah. Sid, fine, but like he finally started to feel like a person, and now he's gone. Ahmed Johnson feels like a goddamn star, and he did get to finish the show with an immaculate Pearl River Plunge on The Undertaker, which is still in Pearl River Plunge, might be the coolest fucking finisher.
Starts off looking like it's a pedigree, and then just this alley-oop flip. Yep.
Yeah, it looks incredible. And he's such a monster. He's so huge, and he's getting comfortable talking, but...
Yeah, he kind of is the Brahma Bull.
Yeah, he's a fucking monster.
How about best performer of the night? I mean, it's Austin and Michaels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, I guess you could give the edge to Austin because he has...
Well, he has that cool.
I'm right behind you.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was getting at. Yeah.
With the Pillman thing
earlier. It's like, so you give the edge to him because Sean doesn't do any like interesting promo stuff on this show.
Yeah.
Whereas Austin has that really fun moment with Pillman, and then he also lets everybody know that the finish was okay with just a smirk and a smile as they walk back. So it's got to be Austin.
And how about most surprising?
Undertaker being a bitch. Like, just like Undertaker being treated that way and was very bizarre. Because I didn't, you know, I haven't watched the show before. I knew exactly, like, on the show when I was like, oh, that's the angle. I know where this goes. But I didn't know that this is how they got there. Mm-hmm. So seeing that was surprising, and seeing The Undertaker just kind of be forced to be a wiener was bizarre and very surprising.
Most surprising doesn't really have to do with much, like, individual match or anything on this show. It's more so that I think I might have liked the 1995 King of the Ring a little bit more. And that they decided to just continue on with the King of the Ring for a few more years after this, because you'd figure this would just be the...
Oh, they do more after this?
The dead one.
Huh.
Maybe they don't. I guess I'm trying to remember now. I thought they continued. I mean, they have more Kings of the Ring, but I guess I don't remember if there's a pay-per-view.
Yeah, but yeah, as far as pay-per-view goes, it's like on TV. It's a little different.
There's at least one in 98 and 99.
Oh, wow.
Let's see if there's actually a King of the Ring, though. There is a 98.
The pay-per-view?
I remember who 98 is. Don't remember 99, but...
That's an interesting one.
I know at some point Edge is King of the Ring.
But on television?
I can't remember if... I want to say, yeah. There's a King of the Ring where Kurt Angle and Shane McMahon are fighting each other, and they have bad glass that doesn't break.
Oh. That's a horrible one in 99.
Oh, wow. I'm
trying to remember.
Steve Blackman.
Might be close.
Close.
Okay.
That's right.
There's one in 2000.
He Who Shall Remain Nameless won it in the early 2000s. Because, you know, he's being erased from the W currently.
Yeah.
Smells like Croc Kresner.
Yeah, I was going for an F5 job.
2000 still won.
But these are pay-per-views, not just, like, on television. Yeah. Okay.
Because, you know, then 10 years from this show or whatever is when you have the King Booker and Queen Charmel.
So, like, King of the Ring now is essentially the...
Raw.
No.
Okay, so it runs through 2002 as a pay-per-view, and then... They don't do another one until 2015.
The pay-per-view?
The pay-per-view.
Is that the Shane? I don't know. Like, is that the Sheamus one? But I don't remember.
2015?
No, that's way long from Sheamus.
I was like,
yeah.
I got some bad news for you on that one.
Hottest king ever.
Who?
Bad news.
Bad news, Barrett. So the tournament returned.
Wait, the tournament
returned in 2006, but there wasn't an associated pay per view because the finale was held at Judgment Day.
Okay.
Semifinals and finals of the 2015 tournament aired exclusively.
So it's kind of nothing at that point.
On the network.
Well, there was a year with Regal. That one I really wish could have lasted.
So it was 2002. The Booker year then, probably.
I don't think it would have been yet.
That was the last year.
I think his may have been just a TV championship, or not championship, but a TV tournament, not an actual pay-per-view. Because he still...
No, 2002 is our person who's being eliminated.
Totally eliminated?
Yeah.
Total elimination. The So King of the Ring now is basically Booker. Like... They upped it by making it Money in the Bank, almost, right?
I mean, that's kind what they
of. Yeah, I mean, Money in the Bank too. At least gives you something. King of the Ring,
because like I guess Elimination Chamber or Money in the Bank would be the one. But Money in the Bank, you still have like a
2006 was King Booker, but it was just a tournament on SmackDown.
Yep.
But the finals held at Judgment Day. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously best King of the Ring.
Oh, yeah. I just had to look to see 99 to because of your reaction. I totally forgot he won that.
Yeah. And now for a look back even further into the history of wrestling.
The dusty finish.
Ravishing Rick Rude had returned from Japan with the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship, going right back into a feud with Sting. But Rude wasn't willing to give the Stinger a title shot until the Ravishing One was tricked into signing a contract for the match, while he thought he was signing an autograph for a fan. The match would take place on April 17th, 1994, at Spring Stampede in Rosemont, Illinois. Sting would immediately attack when Rude entered the ring, but the Ravishing One retaliates to work the Stinger's back before applying a sleeper, only to release it as he thinks he has the match won. Sting fires up with a backdrop and a Stinger splash that ends up sandwiching the ref as well. Sting then places the Ravishing One in a scorpion deathlock when Harley Race and Big Van Vader would appear. The Stinger would fight them off until Rude could clip the knee and goes for the Rude Awakening, when Race would try to hit Sting with a chair, but he would duck, causing the Ravishing One to take the blow and allowing the Stinger to make the cover for the pin to become the WCW International World Heavyweight Champion for the first time. Rick Rude would get his rematch 1 month later across the pond in Japan.
Sometimes when you do these, I'm like, man, getting nostalgic for a thing I watched not too long ago, but...
Yep.
I love me some Surfer Sting.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, WCW Rude might be my favorite.
Yeah, I think that it's the best Rude was in ring, fully formed character, like...
Him and Medusa together were just...
So good.
Magic.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's like, oh, it sucks that Hogan comes in and Bogarts the whole thing, but... You could see an alternate timeline where Rude doesn't get hurt, and Rude and Sting can be top guys for extended periods of time.
Rude crashes King of the Ring and walks out with everything.
Rick Rude would have been a great King of the Ring.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, WCW Monday Night Nitro.
Ew.
From June 9th, 1997.
You mean
we kept talking about the Raw all through the episode, but we're not going to watch the Raw.
No.
We're going to watch the Nitro.
I imagine something good happens.
I hear it's a pretty good show.
I'm hoping for a 20-minute Glacier versus...
Interview?
Hi-ya!
Yeah.
Yeah. Music from this week's show is Charge of Antoine by Jim Johnston and Undertaker One Arm Man Event. So we're going to play Graveyard Symphony version 2. Also by Jim Johnston.
Who does he think he is? Harry Slash and the Slash Tone?
Well, he's...
Both songs?
He's much better.
If you like this episode or any of our other ones, please go out there, rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast at. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns...
Where the hell are we going? We're going to Boston?
Boston.
Whoa.
Massachusetts.
Well, I've never been to Boston, so if anybody's been to Boston, you should shoot me a message. Reach out to us on our Twitter or X... That they call it X still, even after all this time.
But it's called Twitter. It marks the spot. Everybody knows what it is.
But yes, hit us up on Twitter or shoot us an email or something. Let me know what you enjoyed in Boston. What do I need to bring? What do I need to make? What do I need a special order? Something.
Baked beans.
The candies or actual baked beans?
Well, there's the candy, and then, yeah,
those candies
I don't know.
Are gross.
I mean,
I haven't had them since I was a kid. But
I have family from
then.
Massachusetts, but none of them have lived there for a long time, and they were pretty poor, so I don't think they, you know.
Never been.
Clam chowder.
Oh yeah, a chowder.
Maybe I'll bring some apples.
Apples?
how you like them apples.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I do like my good
as soon as
hunting.
I said it, I was like, I know
1997.
Yeah.
I don't like it, but you can bring tea.
You don't like we'll have tea? A party. I mean, he doesn't like coffee.
I don't like coffee, tea. I'm weird. I know. It's okay.
It's fine. It's just weird. It's like tea is so inoffensive.
What if I bring some, like, twisted tea?
It's got
alcohol in it.
Works for me. But you can do any of those things on our email at wrestlinghistoryx@gmail.com or find us on X at wrestlinghistox. That's wrestling H-I-S-T-O.
It's...
Is there a signature cocktail from the bar Cheers?
Beer.
Nailed it. Yeah. Just a very large amount of beer.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you next week.
Laters.